This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Jim Robbins, the author of The Man Who Planted Trees, a story of lost groves, the science of trees, and a plan. This book has been a revelation to me over the years, and it's a pleasure to welcome Jim because we're going to update everything we know about David Millick, his work at several projects that have all come together now in the Archangel Project, which you can find online. There's a website, a very attractive website, called the Ancient Tree Archive. But this is the Archangel Ancient Tree Archive, formally. Jim, congratulations again, and good evening. And 10 years later, we come to your book for revelations about David Millick, his work, and how the story of trees have been embraced from my reading in these last 10 years. First, born 1949, a near-death experience takes him to a mission in life. What is that NDE, and what was that mission as he first conceived it in the late 20th century? Good evening to you, Jim.
Well, thank you, John, and good evening to you. An NDE is an acronym for near-death experience. And this is a scientifically recognized experience. Obviously, no one, after you die, no one really knows where you're going. But there's a journal of near-death studies, and they've looked at people who have claimed to have died and left their body and then come back and been profoundly transformed. Either they've met angels or they've met people they knew who had passed, and they came back. Many of them came back with a mission. And a lot of the missions are similar in the fact people think that the planet is in trouble, that we're nearing a crisis, or we're in a crisis, and they need to do something to help meet the urgency of that crisis, whether it's air pollution or animal or wildlife that's dying or whatever it is. There are people out there who have come back with a warning for the planet and a way to help.
And David Millick's warning is about trees. And originally, the language has changed over the years since the late 20th century. Originally, his vision was about champion trees. What did he mean by that, Jim?
The original project that I wrote about, it was 20 years ago when I first wrote about it for the New York Times. And if people want to read the story, if they go to the Times website and Google David Millick and Champion Tree Project, the original story will come up. And the story I did was about his and his son's effort to clone the largest tree of every species in the United States, because that was the mission given to him to save the genetics of the big trees. And these big trees, of course, are nothing compared to the big trees that have been cut down. These are what's left. He calls them the runts of the runts. But yet the genetics could be important. So he's cloning them with tissue culture, which just means taking a cutting and then growing the trees from the cutting. And there are some 900 species of trees in the United States. And there's a book called The National Registry of Big Trees, American Forests, that keeps it. And the biggest tree of every species is recorded in its location. And so he would go around knocking on doors and asking people who lived where these trees grew on their land. Some of them he described as big as King Kong. And he would take cuttings, and they would grow them. Now, in recent years, his emphasis has been primarily on the redwoods and the sequoias in California, because they're in big trouble because of drought and hotter temperatures.
It's a surprise to me to learn in your telling in the book that was published a decade ago, and you can update on this, that there was, and perhaps still is, resistance to Millick's program. I'm noting especially the resistance from a group that kept the National Register of Big Trees, but also at the same time, there's hesitation or not endorsement by those who are in charge of federal lands about cloning or taking samples or in some way reproducing DNA. What is the nature of that reservation? What is holding back the complete agreement of the regulators?
Well, there's several reasons. One is that some people think that it doesn't really do that much. Some people don't want to give federal property to an individual, a nonprofit, to grow copies, because that would be essentially giving away a federal property. And some people just think the project is not worthy of the DNA of these trees. So and then some of it is a not invented here syndrome. People feel, well, they're a little jealous that this project has gotten huge attention from press all over the world, London Times, the BBC, Australian press, all across the U.S. And I think there's a bit of jealousy about it as well. So there's lots of reasons, why people have been resistant to the project.
I was very happy to travel to Tokyo some years ago, before the pandemic, Jim. And I was taken to a forest outside of Tokyo that's being recreated. And it reminded me of your book, because the people, my guides, this was the foreign ministry introducing me to private enterprise recreating this forest. My guides would take me from tree to tree, and they were very keen on the cherry trees, of course. Tree to tree and ecosystem to ecosystem, and boast about it. And I was struck in the original telling of this story, the story for David Malark, that he was not equally embraced, although there were exceptions. Let's go to one that I thought was special. This is 2002, about a year after the catastrophe, the attack on New York and Washington. He planted some saplings, and it was celebrated by the senator at the time from Michigan, David Malark's Senator Carl Levin, and people came who were the families of people who had lost their lives 9/11. So there was an embrace of his project at the time. Do I say that correctly, Jim?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And in embracing it, is this something that he's met over the years? In other words, I see the tension of what are you up to? What are you doing with federal trees? But I also see a lot of joy. Is there a way to characterize these two factions? Do they balance each other out?
Well, I think that the resistance to the project is small compared to the acceptance of the project. People are overwhelmed by trees. And my goal with this book was to move. They're the background in the background of our lives. We don't pay a lot of attention to trees. One of the goals of this book was to move trees to the foreground because they're critical. They're kind of eco-technology, and they take care of us in many different ways. And we don't have that understanding. It's not pronounced enough. So I think when people start to think about trees, and they start to think about a tree they climbed when they were young, or a book they read about trees, that moves the appreciation for trees into the forefront. And so that's one of the things he's done, is he's been preaching the gospel of trees all around the world in his own way, and how important they are. And I would point out that the Pulitzer Prize winning book, The Overstory, a novel, featured a person who had a near-death experience and came to an appreciation for trees. So there's something deep here. There's something more than just a stick with leaves. There's an emotional connection to trees. And a lot of people feel about trees the same way they might feel about their pet. There's an emotional connection. And so one of the things he's done is kind of wake that up in people. And I hope the book has done that, too. That's one of my goals.
I'm speaking to Jim Robbins, a longtime correspondent for The New York Times. But right now we're focusing on one of Jim's books that I've read over the years, The Man Who Planted Trees, The Story of Lost Groves, The Science of Trees, and a Plan to Save the Planet. When we come back, what was North America at the beginning when the colonists came from Europe? What was it like, East Coast and West Coast? And what is it like now? I'm John Batchelor.